you will increase your efficiency 20% if you learn to do the tough things first, the ones you don't want to do.
Ray Zinn now imparts his management philosophy in Tough Things First. In this series, Zinn covers it all, from the essence of human happiness.
If you're going to make it a consistent practice of working Saturdays just because you think you've got to work 80 hours a week to be successful, you're just flat out wrong.
To the downside of venture capital.
Well, I guarantee if you don't sweat the small things, the big things are going to become a mess.
And the essence of entrepreneurial discipline.
Don't want to wait until you jump off the cliff to grab a parachute.
Now here's Ray Zinn, Silicon Valley's longest serving CEO and today's guest host.
Hello, everybody. Welcome again to another episode and a very special episode of the Tough Things First podcast. I'm your host today, Guy Smith. And as always, we have Silicon Valley's longest serving CEO, Mr. Ray Zinn, with us. Good morning, Ray.
So good to be with you.
This is a special episode today. Some people in the audience know that you have a philanthropic activity on the side called Zinn Starter. And for the people in the audience who don't know, Zinn Starter gives a little bit of seed money to student entrepreneurs at several colleges around the country to give them that little boost, get them past that idea phase, get them a little bit closer towards market readiness. And it's a marvelous program. I work with the schools directly, and boy, the gratitude that the kids have seeing that they can actually move forward with some rather complex products is invigorating. So one of the things we did was we sent out a call to the students. And we said, you know, this is your chance. Send us a recording. Ask a question of Ray Zinn and use his advice to kind of move you even further forward than he already has by writing his book, Tough Things First. And for the audience, by all means, get a copy of Tough Things First right away. It is pretty much your Silicon Valley handbook on how to succeed as an entrepreneur. So, Ray, what we're going to do today, we're going to play these little audio clips and say a little bit about each of these Zinn Starter fellows and see if you can give them a little boost. Our first one's, and I'm going to mess up her name, Tessa Halzul. She's from our newest Zinn Starter college, Carroll College up in Montana. And she has a business called She Shares, which is on a mission to get people to engage at their core in a community setting. So anyway, this is Tessa's question to you.
In your book, Tough Things First, I was inspired when you correlated managing a business to flying an airplane. What advice would you give to a startup business to help them avoid entrepreneurship vertigo? And what specific tools belong in the instrument six-pack when it does not have the advantage of historical trends to understand which variations in data are inherent in the early growth of a business and which ones are dangerous enough to trigger its stall horns? Thank you.
Well, it has an instant correlation to flying an airplane. I used to be a pilot. And, of course, there's a lot of instruments and a lot of gauges that you need to fly safely. In a business, it's the same way. You know, there's various indicators that are key. So you ought to have a business plan that's very concise. That's kind of your attitude indicators. It's so you can tell if you're going up or down. And you know, in an airplane, you have that's your central instrument is your attitude indicator. And you want to make sure that you're not heading toward the brown, because the brown represents the ground and the blue represents the sky. So you don't want to pull your plane up too fast so that you don't see any more brown. All you see is blue because you've lost your reference. So you want to be able to stay on course, keeping your attitude in the right direction. The way to do this, of course, is to have a very concise business plan that defines what your goals are, and you be able to measure yourself against those goals and help you from either stalling out, because if you see nothing but blue, then there's a potential for stalling out. If you see nothing but brown, which means you're going down, you ultimately will crash. Same in your business. If your plan and your execution on your plan, if you start heading toward the ground or brown, then you're going to go out of business. The most precise way, of course, is to have a business plan and then review that plan regularly to make sure you're not going up too fast, you're not going down too fast. You want to keep on your plan. That means you're flying straight and level, and your attitude is in the right direction. That's kind of the analogy of flying an airplane, is that, attitude is everything. If you bank to the left, or you bank to the right, you have turn a bank indicator. And if you turn too far to the right or to the left, exceed the angle that your plane can handle a turn, you're going to spiral. You're going to also stall out. So, make sure you're not turning in the wrong direction, because you won't reach your destination. And also, another good analogy in flying an airplane is that you don't want to just jerk on the wheel up or down, control wheel, that is, or turn dramatically right and left. Some people call it chasing the needle, and you don't want to do that, because otherwise you'll get yourself disoriented, and you can get vertigo. Having the ability to just gently, your hands on the controls, and gently make these turns and going up and down to land, or to take off, or to bank your plane right or left. You do it gently. Same thing with running a company. You want to gently control your company, not let yourself just chase the needle, as they say. And every time the airplane goes up a little bit, you push it down. Every time the airplane goes down a little bit, you pull it up. You don't want to do that. You want to kind of gently handle the controls as you run the company. Hopefully, Tessa, that answers your question.
Well, while we're on this path, talking about stall horns, I know one of the things that you mention often in Tough Things First is cash management. Cash is king. What kind of stall horns vis-a-vis cash should a startup have in place?
That's a good question, Guy. So we do talk about, when you start your business, you want to make sure you have enough cash to take it to profitability. Otherwise, you're going to be chasing the needle. You're going to be constantly going out trying to raise more money. And that detracts from running your business. The other thing, of course, is to have enough fuel in your tank. And that means that you should have at least 1/4 worth of cash on hand, so that you can survive the following quarter. And so, that's having enough fuel. Again, it goes to this same concept of that we talked about a second ago, that you want to have enough cash to take you to profitability, or you want to have enough gas in your tank to take you to your destination and land safely.
Excellent points. We'll move on now to Kyle Jones. Kyle, for a Zen Starter Fellow, has one of the more interesting and unique businesses. It's called Pond Doctor, and he's basically in the business of making sure that trout ponds are a healthy ecosystem. And I can see this both in terms of environmental management, but also for the trout farming industry as well. So anyway, this is Kyle Jones's question for you.
When growing a company, how do you begin to strategically give up responsibilities in your company without sacrificing the quality of the output?
Oh, being able to delegate is a talent. It's almost an art form. So you have to have good people around you. So when you start your company, make sure you have people that you can trust, that are loyal, that are responsible, that will execute in accordance with your direction, because you're going to set the mission. You're going to say, here is where we want to go. And they have to buy in. They have to be bought in, as they say, to the plan, and also their willingness to follow your direction. You can tell that by giving them assignments and see how they execute on those assignments. And don't be afraid to delegate. It's that entrepreneur that can't delegate that ends up auguring himself into the ground, using that flying analogy, because, you can't, in a flying an airplane, usually if it's a big complex plane, you have two pilots. You have a co-pilot as well as the pilot. And that co-pilot is there to back up the pilot. And because the pilot has other things and responsibilities in running and flying the plane, and the co-pilot's there to assist them. And so you need a good co-pilot in your company to help you properly navigate to your destination. And if you don't let your co-pilot fly the plane at times, then, of course, he's not going to have that skill necessary to land the airplane in the event that you're not able to take over the controls yourself. So there will be times when you're going to be out of pocket. You're going to have to be off either on a business trip or off doing other things. And in the case of Pond Doctor, you know, you're going to have to be out there trying to get customers, and you need a manager that can go out and manage the, you know, the application of the chemicals and so forth in the pond to ensure your customers are happy with the outcome. But you can't be both selling and managing the crew at the same time. So don't be afraid to train and to trust your people.
Excellent advice. I know from my career experience that letting go of the reins, trusting other people has always been an issue for me. And I think that's one of the leadership tactics that people need to learn early on, is to how to graduate people into their roles, assure that they're capable of them, and then go ahead and give them everything that they need to execute well. We'll move on to the next question. This is interesting. This is by a different Kyle. Kyle Gillis. I wonder what it is about the Zen Starter that attracts people with the name of Kyle. But anyway, Kyle's up at West Virginia University, one of our most enthusiastic Zen Starter schools. He's in the STEM education company industry. And this is Kyle Gillis's question for you.
As the longest standing CEO in Silicon Valley and a previous space enthusiast, I'm wondering if you're going to be one of the first people on a commercial flight to space.
Well, I don't think so, Kyle. Number one, I like to keep my feet on the ground, except when I travel back and forth on trips to visit my family or to take care of business. So, no, don't count on me being one of the ones that are going to be going into outer space. I have enough outer space experiences running my company and just dealing with these Zen Starter schools. So that's enough challenge and enough excitement so that I don't need to take off and go into outer space. But some people think that sometimes my direction and some of the things I do is kind of spacey, but I don't plan to be one of the ones that joins the outer space group.
Well, and that's where you and I differ, Ray. If Richard Branson offered me a free ticket on his rocket, I would go tomorrow. That just sounds like a boatload of fun to me.
Yeah, but you made a comment, if he offered you a ticket. But don't forget, he's not offering you a ticket. You have to buy that ticket and then be prepared to go on that trip. So, nothing in life worth having is free. So if he had to give you that ticket, it won't be near the experience.
Well, that's true, but I just don't happen to have $250,000 to blow on a plane ride this week.
Okay, the operative word is blow on a plane ride. Yeah.
Oh my.
And I feel the same way. I don't want to blow $250,000 just to get the hair on the back of my neck to stand up.
You can do that just by watching the evening news.
There you go. That's true.
So our next question comes from Keegan Muller, I believe his last name is pronounced. He's a mechanical engineering senior, and he's developed something I find kind of interesting, because it's one of those products that's so simple, so universal. It's in our lives almost every day. But he's making devices that go on traffic cones to increase their usefulness in certain situations by the use of lights and other mechanisms. So anyway, this is Keegan's question for you.
So I'm past the manufacturing stage of the startup, and I really just have to make sales now and gain traction in the market. So I'm planning on going to trade shows, and I've been calling companies, but if you were in my position, how would you go about gaining traction if you had a product like this in today's world?
Well, you know, that's a complex question, because if you don't have your manufacturing sources lined up, you're not going to be able to determine what to sell the product for. You know, if you watch Shark Tank, one of the first questions they ask is, why can't you lower the price? And so you have to look at what the sale price of your product is going to be, and that'll help determine where you manufacture the product. For example, you want to make sure your gross margins are north of 50%. And so that may put you either local manufacturing, or it may have to go offshoring. The first thing you want to do is determine what kind of price point your product's going to get in the marketplace, and then decide where you can build it. And volume will be the determining factor as to how, what kind of pricing you're going to be able to get. So, and with your product, it's going to be high volume, very high volume. And so, you're going to have to find a source that can hit your volumes at the price point you need in order to have a gross margin in excess of 50%.
Well, that's good advice. One of the things I've noticed being a marketing strategist is that price sensitivity is highly variable from market to market. But you're spot on that in this particular market where it's high volume, a lot of government agencies involved and whatnot, there's going to be a significant degree of price sensitivity. So knowing where that price point is and then making sure that your manufacturing chain will get you both to that price point and to acceptable profitability seems like a must do before you actually go out and start beating the bushes for sales.
Right. But you need to find out what the market will bear. That's what will help determine where you're going to manufacture your product. So it sounds like it's a fairly low cost item, and to have a high gross margin may force you to go offshore. Then you have to be careful about where you offshore your manufacturing to make sure it's a reliable source and that somebody doesn't steal your IP.
And for Keegan's benefit, let me just go ahead and say that doing a study, finding out what that price point is critical. I got hired on to a software company ages ago. And when I came in, I saw the price point for their primary product. I said, why did you guys pick this price? And they replied, well, that's pretty much what software goes for in this industry. So I did a survey of the existing customer base, and one of the things I found out was that they would be willing to pay 25% more for the product than we were asking. So we raised the prices 25%, actually saw an increase in sales because it gave it kind of a Mercedes-Benz effect versus the competition. So we got 25% additional revenue the next year just by knowing what our price point was. So by all means, go out there and do the research and find out what the market will bear. Well, we've got one more question. This comes from Andrew Rhodes. He's a PhD candidate in aerospace engineering, a field that you have been in your past. But oddly enough, he's in the kombucha industry, setting up a brewery for making these fermented black teas. And this is Andrew's question for you.
The purpose of a business is to make a product that customers like in order to turn a profit. But in today's world, we also have to be cognizant of the environmental impacts that our business imposes. So how do you manage the environmental impacts of your business from manufacturing and production and distribution?
Well, Andrew, that's a tough one because it depends upon what kind of environmental issues you're going to have in processing your product. And without knowing that, it'll be hard for me to tell you. I mean, almost every state and every country has regulations regarding environmental demands to make sure they're not cancerous, make sure they're not pollutants in the air, or that you don't use too much water, as they say. So, for example, if your product is going to require a lot of water in the manufacturing, you don't want to go to a drought area, because your cost of your water is going to be high. They're going to limit you how much water you can use. If it requires a lot of water, go to an area where there's not a problem with water, like Scotland, for example. You know, Scotland's got lots of water, and other areas in the country have a lot of good water supply. If it's an air pollution type problem, you don't want to go to an urban area where it's a lot high density. Because you're going to have too many restrictions that will preclude you from emitting a lot of air pollutants. So you need to go to a wide open area like Montana or Wyoming or something like that, where there's not near the air restrictions that there are in the more urban or densely populated areas.
That's great advice. I want to amplify on this a little bit, though, because there tend to be two factors here. There's what is the regulatory environmental protections, but then there's also the social consciousness environmental protections. I was having a discussion last week with somebody locally here who said something interesting. He said he goes and he researches what the regulatory requirements are. This gives him his baseline and his insight into how he can achieve those issues. And then that gives him the inspiration as to how he can go beyond what the regulatory requirements are and be even more of an environmental steward. So in some respects, I think they kind of go hand in glove. You can go beyond what's required of you, but start with the requirements to set the baseline in the direction.
Well, you know, it brings up a good point because I do recall a story. I have a ranch in Montana, and a friend of mine had a dairy, doesn't have it anymore, but had a dairy that was way out in the country. I mean, way what he called out in the boonies. This is like 40, 50 years ago. Since then, the city has moved out toward him. It, you know, people have sold off their properties and they started building subdivisions around his dairy. Then they complained about the smell. Well, you know, that's why he moved quite a ways from town early on 50 years ago, was so that people in the town would not have to smell the cow manure. And but as the people then began to build subdivisions around his dairy, and they complained bitterly about the smell, caused him then to ultimately sell his dairy and close it down, and sell it. So, you know, you may be moving to an area where currently it's acceptable, but, you know, in time, if you have the community move out to where you're manufacturing your product and it's going to cause a smelling problem or, be obnoxious, you know, you're going to have to move your factory. So, you know, look at the city planning, look at what the, you know, plans are for developing the area. And so that your product doesn't have a short life because the city ends up moving out to where you are.
Which would cause a perpetual problem because you would have to keep building and moving and building and moving.
Exactly.
But I also see an interesting problem with this in that it would be great if you could go build your factory out in the middle of the boonies somewhere. But if you're too far away from an urban center, how are you ever going to find enough employees to help grow the company? Because they're not going to want to commute out into the middle of nowhere every day.
Yeah, that's true. But you may be forced to do that because of the nature of the toxicity or the smell of the product may be too obnoxious for even your employees. So you're going to have to make sure that you have some way to control that environment that they're going to be working in.
Well, and it may also lean upon some local regulations. There's a town nearby where I live where there's a paper mill, and it's right in the middle of the town, and the town grew up around the paper mill. But the local regulations, you know, basically said, well, if you don't like the smell, go move somewhere else. And the people who live in that town have lived there all their lives, and they don't mind the smell, or they've just so grown so used to it that, you know, you would ask them about it and they would go, what smell? Everything smells normal around here. So I have a feeling local regulations probably factor in to a significant degree in terms of environmental considerations.
Well, not only that, but ultimately people, you know, things change. And so, you know, what, you know, maybe 50 years ago, the environment was good for your particular product. But now, because of people who are either not involved in your industry or don't care about the product you're manufacturing, they start objecting. And if they can rally enough support, they can actually shut you down or make it so miserable for you, you'd have to shut yourself down or move.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, anyway, that's the last of the Zen Starter Fellows questions that we have for today. For the audience, first things first, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. Continue getting Ray Zen's wisdom every week. We've got some exciting podcast guests in the pipeline. And by all means, if you haven't already, do get a copy of both of Ray's books. The first one, of course, Tough Things First. When you look at the reader reviews on Amazon for this book, You see that it's educational, inspirational. It has literally changed lives of people who are looking for a path forward in business. Imre's other book, The Zen of Zen, a little bit more on the soft side. It talks about people and the interrelationship of things, both business, community, society, etc. More on the inspirational side, but again, it's changing the way people see themselves as part of the larger scheme of things, and well worth the read. So, Ray, thank you very much, and thank you for funding the Zen Starter program, one of the most exciting things that I've seen happening in the entrepreneurial generation cycle with inside of the university system.
Well, thank you, Guy. Appreciate that very much.
You've been listening to Tough Things First, candid talk with Silicon Valley's longest-serving CEO, Ray Zinn. Drop by the contact page at toughthingsfirst.com for more about the book, more podcasts, and links to Ray's Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn pages to keep up with Ray Zinn's wisdom daily.